had to go on in their theorizing was themselves. The answer, they reasoned, must be found in some configuration of their areas of expertise. Working backward, what sort of problem might such skills solve? As Calixte had bemoaned, most of the theories were martial ones, involving conquest, weapons, and defense. Laszlo could see why. Siege engines, explosives, and metal did suggest such a direction. But he didn't think it would be anything like that. Errol Fain had said the problem posed no danger to them, and he could ill imagine that the Tysicane general would leave his city for so long if it were under threat. But something, he had said, still haunted them. He had used that word, haunt. Laszlo alone had considered that he might mean it literally. Suppose there were ghosts. Godslayer. The ghosts of dead gods? He wouldn't be putting that into Calixte's book. For one thing, these were hardly the people you would summon to address such a dilemma. And for another, how they would laugh at him if he did. Was that why he hadn't given a theory? Because he was afraid of being laughed at? No. He thought it was because he wanted Calixte to be right. For the truth to be stranger than anything they could imagine. He didn't want to guess the answer, not even for 500 silver. He wanted to climb to the top of the cusp tomorrow, and open his eyes and see.
The moment you see the city, Errol Fain had promised them, you will understand what this is about.
The moment you see the city. The moment. Whatever the problem was, it would be clear at a glance. That was another piece of the puzzle, but Laszlo didn't want to ponder it.
I don't want to guess, he told Calixte. I want to be surprised.
So be surprised, she said, exasperated. You don't have to guess right. You only have to guess interesting.
They were back in camp now. The low-slung woolen tents had gone up, and the Tysicane had penned the spectrals in a larger pavilion of the same boiled wool. The camels, with their shaggy coats, passed their nights under the cold of the stars. The drovers had unloaded them, stacking their bales into a windbreak, though thus far the evening was still. The plume of smoke from the fire rose straight up, like the charmed ropes in the marketplace in Alkenost that had hung suspended in thin air, whilst small boys clambered up and down them. The Ferengi were still waiting for their dinner. There were carrion birds in the sky, circling and cawing ugly cries, that Laszlo imagined translated as,
Die, so we can eat you.
Errol Fain released a message falcon, and it rose through the ranks of them, screaming a raptor's warning before striking out for the cusp. Laszlo watched it go, and this, more than anything, drove home to him the nearness of their destination. The unbelievable imminence of his impossible dream.
All right, he told Calixte. You win.
She put back her head and ululated, and everyone in camp turned to look.
Hush, Banshee, he said, laughing. I'll give you one theory, as wild and improbable as I can make it.
And beautiful and full of monsters, she reminded him.
And beautiful and full of monsters, he agreed,
and he knew then what he would tell her. It was the oldest story in the world. Chapter 15. The Oldest Story in the World. The Seraphim were the world's earliest myth. Laszlo had read every book of lore in the Great Library, and every scroll, and every song and saga that had made its way from voice to voice over centuries of oral tradition, to finally be captured on paper, and this was the oldest. It went back several millennia, perhaps as many as seven, and was found in nearly every culture, including the Unseen City, where the beings had been worshipped,
They might be called Enkiel, or Angelin, or Angels, Srith, or Seraphane, or Seraphim. But the core story remained constant, and it was this. They were beings of surpassing beauty, with wings of smokeless fire. Six of them, three male, three female. And long, long ago, before time had a name, they came down from the skies. They came to look and see what manner of world it was, and they found rich soil and sweet seas, and plants that dreamed they were birds and drifted up to the clouds on leaves like wings. They also found the Igi, a huge and hideous race that kept humans as slaves, pets, or food, depending on the version of the tale. The Seraphim took pity on the humans, and for them they slew the Igi, every one, and they piled the dead at the edge of the great dust sea and burned them on a pyre the size of a moon. And that, the story went, is how man claimed ascendancy over the world that was Zeru, while the demons were stricken from it by the angels. Once upon a long-lost time, people had believed it, and had believed, too, that the Seraphim would return one day and sit in judgment over them. There had been temples and priestesses and fire rites and sacrifice, but that was a long time ago. No one believed in the old myths anymore. "Get out your pencil," Laszlo told Calixte, emerging from his tent. He had taken the time, first, to groom his spectral, Lixa, and then himself. His last sand bath. He wouldn't miss it. "Are you ready for this? It's going to be good. Extremely improbable."
"Let's have it then."
"All right." He cleared his throat. Calixte waggled her pencil impatient. "The problem," he said, as though it were perfectly reasonable, "is that the Seraphim have returned." She looked delighted. She bent her head and started scribbling. From the direction of the Ferengi, Laszlo heard a laugh.
"Seraphim!" someone scoffed. "Absurd!"
He ignored them.
"Of course you know the Seraphim," he told Calixte. "They came down from the skies. But do you know where they came to? They came here." He gestured around him. "The Great Dust Sea, it's called in the tales. What else but the Elmuthaleth? And the funeral pyre the size of a moon?" He pointed to the single feature in the great flat land.
"The cusp?"
Calixte asked. "Look at it. It's not crystal. It's not marble. And it's definitely not ice."
The sun had melted to a stripe of copper, and the sky was deepening blue. The cusp looked more otherworldly even than by daylight, aglow as though lit from within.
"Then what is it?"
Calixte asked. "The fused bones of slaughtered demons," said Laszlo, just as Brother Cyrus had once told him.
"Thousands of them. The holy fire burned away their flesh, and whatever their bones were made of, it melted into glass. You can still see their skulls, all full of teeth, and make out their curved spines and long skeletal feet. Carrion birds nest in their great eye sockets. Nothing can survive there but eaters of the dead."
Calixte had stopped writing. Her eyes were wide.
"Really?"
she asked, breathless. Laszlo broke into a smile. "Extremely improbably," he was about to remind her. But someone else answered first.
"Of course not really," said the voice, with a drawl of exaggerated patience.
It was Eblis Todd, the builder. He had not appreciated sharing the Godslayer's invitation with the girl who'd
scuttled up the cloud spire like a bug,
and had been heard to voice such complaints as,
"It demeans those of us of true accomplishment to count a thief in our number."
Now he said to her, with utmost condescension,
"Dear girl, Your credulity is as vast as this desert. One might get lost in it and never again encounter fact or reason.
A couple of the others laughed with him, marveling that anyone could believe such nonsense. Thion Nero was leaning back against the windbreak, gilded by both sunset and firelight.
Strange believes it too,
he told Drave, the explosionist, who sat by his side, bearing poorly by proximity. The golden godson managed to look dashing, even in the midst of a desert crossing. The sun had treated his skin to a happy golden hue, and bleached the tips of his hair to a pale gleam. The lean travel rations had only accentuated the exquisite modelling of his features, and his short beard, kept trimmed unlike everyone else's, lent him maturity and consequence, without sacrificing any of his youthful splendour. Drave, by contrast, was wiry and weather-beaten beyond his years, which was somewhere near 30. Hailing from Myelin, where sun was scant, he was very fair, and had suffered in the Almuthaleth more than anyone. Burning and peeling, his face a patchwork of pink and red, with brownish curls of dead skin sloughing away. The two made an unlikely pair, the alchemist and the explosionist. They had fallen into step back in Alkanost, and taken to riding and eating meals together. In anyone else, it would have looked like friendship. But Laszlo couldn't see it as anything so benign. Thion Nero hadn't had friends in Zosma so much as admirers, and Drave seemed willing to fill that role, even fetching him his breakfast, and shaking the sand out of his boots for him, and all without the reward of gratitude. Laszlo wondered if his own long-ago thank you was the only one Nero had ever spoken. He didn't pity Drave, though. It was clear to him that the explosionist wasn't after friendship, but the secret of gold. Good luck with that, he thought, wry.
He believes in everything, even ghosts,
Thion added, drawing a willing snigger from Drave before turning his eyes on Laszlo.
Don't you, Strange?
It reminded Laszlo of that awful day at the inquiry's desk, when he'd requisitioned Laszlo's books. The sudden cut of his eyes singling Laszlo out. The barbed question, intended to discomfort. And he felt a shade of his old fear, too. This whole journey, Nero had hardly spoken to him, except to make little sharp jibes. But Laszlo felt the burn of his gaze sometimes, and wondered if the alchemist still counted him a cost, the only person alive who knew his secret. As to Thion's question, his reply was noncommittal.
I admit, I prefer an open mind to a closed one, he said. You call it an open mind to believe men flew down from the skies on fiery wings? And women, said Laszlo. It's a woeful species that's all male.
More like a non-existent species, remarked Calixte. Men lacking both wombs and good sense.
A disturbing thought occurred to Laszlo. He turned to Ruza, shifting into unseen to ask him, Are there male and female Threaves? Dear God, tell me those things don't mate.
Baby Threaves must come from somewhere, said Ruza.
But how would they even find each other? Laszlo wondered.
Let alone...
He let the rest pass unsaid.
I don't know, but I bet when they do, they make the most of it.
The young warrior waggled his eyebrows. Laszlo grimaced. Ruza shrugged.
What? For all we know, Threave love stories are the most beautiful of all time.
Calixte snorted. She, too, had troubled herself to learn the language, with Tsara her principal teacher, as Ruza was Laszlo's. The two women were sitting together now, and Calixte whispered something to Tsara that made the warrior bite her lip and flush.
Pardon me,
cut in Thion.
with the pinched look of someone who believes he's being mocked. And since he hadn't bothered to learn unseen, he could almost be forgiven for thinking so. He restated his question.
You believe men and women flew down from the skies on fiery wings?
Laszlo had never said he believed in the seraphim. Even in his books, he'd made no such claim. He had nothing like proof, or even faith. It simply interested him, greatly, how all the cultures of Zeru were underpinned by the same story. At the very least, it spoke to the migration patterns of ancient people. At the very most, it spoke to a good deal more. But all that was neither here nor there. He wasn't trying to win the theory purse, after all. He was only satisfying Calixte.
I see no harm in entertaining all ideas, he said. For example, could you have arrived at Azoth if you'd arbitrarily closed your mind to certain chemical compounds?
Thion's jaw clenched. When he spoke again, a tightness had replaced the mockery in his tone.
Alchemy is a science. There is no comparison. Well, I'm no alchemist, Laszlo said, affable. You know me, Strange the Dreamer, head in the clouds.
He paused and added with a grin.
Miracles for breakfast.
Thion's face went stony at the mention of the book. Was Laszlo threatening him? Absolutely not. He would never break his triple promise, and he heard his own taunts with a sense of unreality. He wasn't a junior librarian at the Golden Godson's mercy anymore, and whatever awe he had felt for him was gone. Still, it was stupid to goad him. He turned back to Calixte.
Now, where was I?
She referred to her notebook.
The fused bones of slaughtered demons, she supplied. Right. So it was here the seraphim came down. Or more like, there, in the city.
He gestured toward the cusp and beyond.
And there they slew the unwholesome Iji, leaving the young and attractive race of man and woman free of foes, and went away again. Millennia passed. Humans thrived. And then one day, as prophesied, the seraphim returned.
He waited for Calixte's pencil to catch up.
Okay, she said. You've got the monsters part, and I suppose I'll grant you beauty for your lovely face, if not for the seraphim.
She added in a tease. Laszlo didn't even blush. If Calixte did find his face lovely, which he found distinctly implausible, considering its centerpiece, there was nothing like attraction or desire behind it. No, he had seen the way she looked at Zara, and the way Zara looked at her, and that made for a fairly thorough education on the subject of desire.
But what,
Calixte asked him,
is the problem? I'm getting to it, said Laszlo,
though in truth he hadn't quite figured out that part of his wild and improbable theory. He looked around. He saw that it wasn't only the Ferengi paying attention, but the unseen as well. The Tizakane, the camel drovers, the old Oyanaks, the shaman. They couldn't understand common tongue, but his voice naturally caught their ear. They were accustomed to listening to him tell stories, though that usually happened after dinner, when the sky was dark, and he could only see their faces by the flickering light of the fire. He did a quick translation for their benefit. Errol Fane was listening with wry amusement, and Azarine too, who was perhaps more to him than his second-in-command, though Laszlo couldn't work out the nature of their relationship. The closeness between them was palpable, but also somehow painful. They didn't share a tent, as several pairs of warriors did, and though they showed no physical affection, it was clear to anyone with eyes that Azarine loved Errol Fane. Errol Fane's feelings were harder to interpret. For all his warmth, there was something guarded about him. The two shared a history, but what kind?
In any case, this wasn't Laszlo's current puzzle. The problem, he thought, casting about. Seraphim and Eiji. He caught sight of Muzev, the natural philosopher, standing over the cook, Majda, with his plate in his hand and a sour look on his face. And that was where his spark of inspiration came from.
The second coming of the Seraphim. It may have begun with awe and reverence, but what do you suppose? He said,
first in common tongue and then in unseen.
It turns out they make terrible guests. Extremely impressed with themselves. Never lift a finger. Expect to be waited on hand and foot. They won't even put up their own tents, if you can credit it, or help with the camels. They just lurk about, waiting to be fed.
Calixte wrote, biting her lip to keep from laughing. Some of the Tizakane did laugh, as did Solteran and Oswin, the married couple with the flying machines. They could laugh because the criticism wasn't aimed at them. Accustomed to farming the Thanagost Badlands, they weren't the sort to sit idle, but helped out however they could. The same could not be said of the others, who were stiff with affront.
"Is he suggesting we ought to perform labor?" asked Belabra, the mathematician, to a stir of astonished murmurs.
"In short," Laszlo concluded, "the purpose of this delegation is to persuade the Seraphim to be on their way. Politely, of course. Failing that, forcible eviction."
He gestured to the delegates.
"Explosions and catapults and so forth."
Solzarin started clapping, so he bowed. He caught sight of Errol Fane again, and saw that his wry amusement had sharpened to a kind of keen appraisal. Azarine was giving him the same frank look, which Laszlo met with an apologetic shrug. It was a ridiculous notion, as well as petty and impolitic, but he hadn't been able to resist. Calixte filled the last page of the book, and he dug out his 10 silver, which was more money than he'd ever held before receiving his first wage from Errol Fane.
"Farewell, good coin,"
he bid it, surrendering it,
"for I shall never see thee more."
"Don't be glum, strange. You might win," said Calixte,
without conviction. She examined the coin and declared that it had
a damned triumphant look about it,
before shoving it into the overstuffed purse. The seams strained. It appeared as though one more coin might split it wide open. The last page in the book, the last space in the purse, and the theory game was ended. They had only now to wait until tomorrow and see who won. The temperature plummeted as the desert fell dark. Laszlo layered his woolen shulno over the linen one and put up his hood. The campfire burned against the deep blue night, and the travelers all gathered in its glow. Dinner was served, and Errol Fane opened a bottle of spirits he'd saved for this night. Their last night of thirst and bland journey food, and aching buttocks and saddle chafe, and dry bathing and grit in every crease of cloth and flesh. The last night of lying on hard ground, and falling asleep to the murmured incantations of the shaman stirring his powders into the fire. The last night of wondering. Laszlo looked to the cusp, subtle in the starlight. The mysteries of Weep had been music to his blood for as long as he could remember. This time tomorrow, they would be mysteries no longer. The end of wondering, he thought, but not of wonder. That was just beginning. He was certain of it.
Chapter 16. 100 Smithereens of Darkness. Sarai was out of sorts. After dinner, Feral ripped a snowstorm from some far-off sky, and they had snow for dessert, with plum jam stirred in. But she could scarcely enjoy it. Sparrow and Ruby threw snowballs at each other, their laughter a bit too sharp, their aim a bit too true, and Minya slipped away somewhere, promising to release the ghost, Ariel, to his natural evanescence. Sarai hated it when Minya brought new ghosts into the citadel. Each one was like a mirror that reflected her monstrosity back at her.
Lest you forget you are an abomination. Here's an old woman who'll wail at the sight of you. Here's a young man who'll think he's in hell.
It did wonders for her sense of self.
Why must she do it?
She said aloud. It was only her and Feral in the gallery now, and he was bent over his book. It wasn't paper, but sheets of thin mazarthium, etched all in symbols. If they were letters, they couldn't have been more different from the fluid and beautiful alphabet of Weep, which Great Ellen had taught them to read and write. That had no angles, only curves. This had no curves, only angles. Sarai thought it looked brutal, somehow. She didn't know how Feral could keep poring over it, when for years he'd had no luck deciphering it. He said he could almost sense the meaning, as though it were right there, waiting to resolve, like a kaleidoscope in need of turning. He traced a symbol with his fingertip.
"Why must who do what?"
he asked.
"Minya, drag ghosts in here. Bring their hate into our home."
Sarai heard herself. How petty she sounded, complaining about the inconvenience to herself. She couldn't say what she was really feeling, though. It was unspeakable that she should pity a human, ghost or living.
"Well,"
said Feral distractedly, "at least we have you to bring our hate into their homes." Sarai blinked a series of rapid blinks and looked down at her hands. There was no malice in Feral's words, but they stung like a pinch. Maybe she was sensitive in the wake of Ruby's certainty of doom and the revelation that she herself shared it. And maybe it was her envy that Feral conjured snow and Sparrow grew flowers and Ruby made warmth and fireworks, while she did what she did.
"Is that what I do?"
she asked, her voice coming out brittle.
"It's a wonder you don't call me Hatebringer."
Feral looked up from his book.
"I didn't mean it in a bad way," he said.
Sarai laughed without mirth.
"Feral, how could hate ever not be bad? If it's deserved, if it's vengeance."
Vengeance. Sarai heard the way he said it, and she understood something. Vengeance ought to be spoken through gritted teeth, spittle flying, the cords of one's soul so entangled in it that you can't let it go, even if you try. If you feel it, if you really feel it, then you speak it like it's a still beating heart, clenched in your fist, and there's blood running down your arm, dripping off your elbow, and you can't let go. Feral didn't speak it like that at all. It might have been any word. Dust, or teacup, or plum. There was no heat in it. No still beating heart. No blood. Vengeance was just a word to him. The realization emboldened her.
"What if it isn't?"
she asked, hesitant.
"What if what isn't what?"
Sarai wasn't even sure what she meant. If it wasn't vengeance, if it wasn't deserved, or, still more primary, what if it wasn't even hate she felt for humans, not anymore? What if everything had changed so slowly she hadn't even felt it while it was happening?
"It's not vengeance," she said, rubbing her temples. "I spent that years ago."
She looked at him, trying to read him.
"You don't still feel it, do you?" "Not really. I'm sure Ruby and Sparrow don't."
Feral looked uneasy. Sarai's words were simple enough, but they challenged the basic tenet of their lives, that they had an enemy, that they were an enemy. She could tell there was no great hate left in him.
but he wouldn't admit it. It would be a kind of blasphemy. Even if we didn't, he hedged. Minya's got enough for all of us. He wasn't wrong about that. Minya's animus burned brighter than Ruby's fire, and for good reason. She was the only one of them who actually remembered the carnage. It had been 15 years. Sarayan Ferrell was 17 now. Sparrow was 16, and Ruby not quite. And Minya? Well, she might look like a 6-year-old child, but she wasn't one. In truth, she was the eldest of the 5 of them, and the one who had saved them 15 years back, when she really was 6 years old, and the rest of them only babies. None of them understood why, or how, but she hadn't aged since that bloody day, when the humans had celebrated their victory over the gods by executing the children they'd left behind. Only the 5 of them had survived, and only because of Minya. Sarai knew the carnage from stolen dreams and memories, but Minya remembered. She had burning coals for hearts, and her hate was as hot now as it had ever been.
I think that's why she does it, said Sarai. Why she brings the ghosts, I mean. So we have to see how they look at us, and we can't ever forget what we are.
That's good, though, isn't it? Countered Ferrell. If we did forget, we might slip up, break the rule, give ourselves away.
I suppose, Sarai allowed.
It was true that fear kept them careful, but what purpose did hate serve? She thought it was like the desert thrieve, a sand beast that could survive for years eating nothing but its own malted skin. Hate could do that too, live off nothing but itself, but not forever. Like a thrieve, it was only sustaining itself until some richer meal came along. It was waiting for prey. What were they waiting for? Sarai could see that Ferrell wouldn't share her conflict, and how could he? The only humans he ever saw were ghosts, still reeling with the first shock of death to find themselves here, in the theater of their nightmares, enslaved to a pitiless little girl as blue as their worst memories. It didn't exactly bring out the best in them, but after 4,000 nights among them, in their homes, on their skin, Sarai knew humans in a way the others couldn't, and she'd lost that easy ability to hate. She let the matter drop.
What Ruby said earlier, she ventured. Do you feel that way too?
Which part? He asked. About the soup being insipid, or hell being interesting. Sarai shook her head, smiling.
You know which part I mean.
Ah, yes. How it's all right to burn our clothes when the mood strikes us, because we're going to die young?
That's the one. Sarai grew hesitant. Ferrell, can you imagine us growing old?
Of course I can, he said without hesitation. I'll be a distinguished elderly gentleman with great long whiskers, 3 doting wives, 12 children.
3 wives?
Sarai cut in.
Who? Us. You're going to marry all of us, are you?
Well, naturally. I wouldn't want anyone to feel left out. Except Minya, and I don't think she'll mind.
No, I think you're right about that, said Sarai, amused. She's not exactly wifely. Whereas you... Oh, yes, so wifely. But how will it work? Will you rotate between us on a schedule, or choose as the mood strikes you?
A schedule does seem more fair, he said, solemn. I know it won't be easy, you all having to share me, but we must make the best of an imperfect situation. He was fighting to keep his mouth composed in its line of earnest gravity, but he couldn't keep the humor from his eyes.
An imperfect situation, Sarai repeated. Is that what we have here?
She gestured all around.
the gallery, the citadel, their precarious, doomed existence.
A bit on the imperfect side, yes,
said Farrell with regret. And they just couldn't maintain their seriousness in the face of such an understatement. Sarai cracked first, tipping into helpless laughter, and Farrell followed. And mirth worked its mundane magic, leeching the tension from Sarai's spine and relieving the cold dread that had been pressing on her all evening. And that's how you go on. You lay laughter over the dark parts. The more dark parts, the more you have to laugh. With defiance, with abandon, with hysteria, any way you can. Sarai suspected that her mother, the goddess of despair, would not have approved. She would have loved her daughter's gift, though. The night grew late. The others went to their rooms. Sarai went too, but not to sleep. Her day was just beginning. Her rooms had been her mother's, and were second in size and splendor only to Minya's, which were a full palace in their own right, enclosed within the body of the citadel, and had been the domain of her father, Scathis, god of beasts and high lord of the Mizarthim, most monstrous of them all. Sarai's were at the extremity of the dexter arm, which was a way of saying right, as sinister was a way of saying left, down the long curved corridor from the gallery. Her door didn't close. Every door in the citadel, everything in the citadel, was frozen as it had been at the moment of Scathis's death. Doors that had been open remained resolutely open. Doors that had been closed were permanently impassable. Vast sectors of the citadel were, in fact, sealed off, their contents a mystery. When the five of them were younger, they had liked to imagine other children surviving in those closed-off wings, leading parallel lives, and they had played at imagining who they might be, and what gifts they had to make their cloistered existence bearable. Great Ellen had told them of children she had known in her years in the nursery, a girl who could project illusions with her mind, a boy who could mimic others' faces, another whose tears could heal any hurt. A beautiful gift, but he was destined to spend his whole life crying. Most enviable to them back then had been the girl who could bring things out of dreams. If she could dream it, she could carry it out with her. Toys and harps and kittens, cakes and crowns and butterflies. They'd loved imagining all the things they'd get if they had that gift. Seed packets for Sparrow to grow a real garden, and books for Feral, who longed to learn more than what the ghosts could teach. For Sarai, a doll she coveted from down in Weep, that she'd seen hugged in a sleeping girl's arms during one of her nocturnal visits. An army for Minya, who had always been grim. For Ruby, a whole jar of honey to eat without sharing.
"You should have that gift instead," she had told Sarai. "It's much nicer than yours." "Nice enough until you have a nightmare,"
Sarai had replied, grudging.
"What if she dreamed a rabbit?"
said Minya, grinning.
"And when she woke up, it bit off her head."
They understood now that if anyone had been locked away in other sectors of the citadel, they would have died within days. The five of them were the only living beings here. Sarai couldn't close her door, but she drew the curtains she'd fixed to cover it. They were supposed to respect one another's curtains, but it was an imperfect system, especially where Minya was concerned. An imperfect situation, Sarai recalled. But the fizz of laughter had gone flat. An antechamber led into the bedroom. Unlike the austere walls of the corridor, this room mimicked the architecture of Weep, with columns supporting an ornamental entablature and soaring, fan-vaulted ceiling. Down in the city, the buildings were stone, intricately carved with scenes from the natural world and the mythic one. Among the loveliest was the Temple of Thakra, at which a dozen master sculptors had labored for 40 years, two of them going blind in the process. The frieze alone boasted 1,000 sparrows, so lifelike
that real birds had been known to while away their lives, romancing them in vain. Here in these chambers were twice as many songbirds, mingling with seraphim and lilies, spectrals and vines. And though the work was likely accomplished in a mere hour or two, they were even more perfect than the ones on the temple. They were wrought in Mesarthium, not stone, and had been neither carved nor cast. That wasn't how Mesarthium worked. The curtained bed occupied a dais in the center of the chamber. Sarai didn't sleep in it. It was too big, like a stage. There was another, more reasonable bed, tucked in an alcove behind the dressing room. When she was younger, she'd supposed it had belonged to a maid. But at some point, she came to understand that it had been for Izagol's consorts, paramours, whatever you chose to call them. Sarai's own father would have slept in this bed when Izagol didn't want him in hers. Her father. When she'd realized that, it had felt like a violation of her own safe place to imagine him here, taking solace in this little bit of privacy while he lay awake, plotting the slaughter of the gods. It was Sarai's bed now, but she wouldn't need it yet for hours. She crossed to the terrace door, barefoot, and stepped out into the moonlight. Sarai was 17 years old, a goddess and a girl. Half her blood was human, but it counted for nothing. She was blue. She was godsborn. She was anathema. She was young. She was lovely. She was afraid. She had russet hair and a slender neck, and wore a robe that had belonged to the goddess of despair. It was too long, and trailed behind her, its hem worn to a sheen from dragging over the floor, back and forth, back and forth. Pacing this terrace, Sarai might have walked as far as the moon and back. Except, of course, that if she could walk to the moon, she wouldn't come back. It was time. She closed her eyes. She closed them tight. Her gift was ugly. She never let anyone see her call it forth. She could teach Ariel a thing or two yet about revulsion, she thought. She took a deep breath. She could feel it burgeoning within her, welling up like tears. She held it in a moment longer. There was always that impulse, to keep it inside, this part of herself, to hide it. But she didn't have that luxury. She had work to do, so she opened her mouth and screamed. It was clearly a scream. The rictus tension in her face, head thrust forward, throat stretched taut. But no sound came out. Sarai didn't scream sound. She screamed something else. It issued forth, a soft, boiling darkness. It looked like a cloud. It wasn't a cloud. 5 seconds. 10. She screamed her silent scream. She screamed an exodus. Streaming forth into the night, the darkness fractured into 100 fluttering bits, like wind-blown scraps of velvet. 100 smithereens of darkness. They broke apart and reformed and siphoned themselves into a little typhoon that swept down toward the rooftops of Weep, whirling and wheeling on soft twilight wings. Sarai screamed moths. Moths and her own mind, pulled into 100 pieces and flung out into the world. Chapter 17. The Muse of Nightmares. All the godsborn had magical gifts, though some of their abilities deserved the term gift more than others. There was no predicting what they would be, and each manifested in its own time, in its own way. Some, like ferals and rubies, made themselves known spontaneously and vividly while they were still babies. Storms and fires in the nursery, snowdrifts and lightning strikes, or bedclothes burned away, leaving nothing but an angry, naked baby, steaming in a Mesarthium bassinet. Other abilities took longer to discover, and depended on environment and circumstance, like sparrows, which needed a garden, or at the very least a seed, in order to show itself. She'd still been crawling when it had. Great Ellen loved to tell the story, how Small Sparrow had beelined across the gallery on chubby hands and knees to the orchids that hadn't bloomed since the carnage. They'd looked like potted sticks, and Great Ellen hadn't stopped the little girl from grabbing at them. There was little enough to play with in the citadel, and the orchids were past hope. She'd been distracted, probably by Ruby, and when next she looked, it wasn't potted sticks she saw, but Sparrow's small, upturned face, transfixed by the sight of a bloom unfurling from the dead wood she clutched in her tiny hands. Orchid witch, cloud thief, bonfire. Their gifts had manifested effortlessly, naturally. The same could not be said for Sarai's. While Feral, Ruby, and Sparrow couldn't remember the time before their magic, she could. She remembered wondering what her gift would turn out to be, and hoping for a good one. The others hoped too. Well, the girls were very small, but Feral and Minya were highly aware. Sarai's gift was their last unknown. They were trapped in the citadel to scrape up a life for themselves however they could, and for as long as they could. And there were gifts that might make that easier. As for Sarai, she didn't just want to make it easier. That wasn't enough. She wanted to save them. There was one gift, above all, that might have done that. It was Scathus's gift, and though most likely to be inherited by his children, Godspawn powers were unpredictable, and there was a chance that it could manifest in others. Sarai knew she didn't have it, though. She'd been tested for it as a baby. They all were. Koriko, goddess of secrets, had been the one to see to it, and to administer other tests to determine the more elusive Godspawn abilities. Koriko was dead now, along with Scathis and Izagol, Letha, Vanth, and Ikirok, the Mizarthim, all murdered by the Godslayer, Errol Fane. The gift Sarai had most wished for wasn't Scathis's gift anyway, but flight. There had been Godspawn who could fly, according to Great Ellen, and she had imagined that one day she might just begin to rise and rise and rise to freedom. In her fantasies, she carried the others away with her, but they never reached a destination, because she couldn't imagine what place there could be in the world for the likes of them. There were good gifts to wish for, and there were bad ones to fear. And the more time passed, the more she worried that hers would be one of those. She was 5 years old, and nothing had happened. 6, and still nothing. And then, not nothing. Not something, either. Not yet, not quite. Just a feeling, growing inside her. And not a good one. At first, it had felt a little like holding in cruel words instead of speaking them. How they sit burning on the back of your tongue like a secret poison, ready to spew into the world. She held it in. She didn't tell anyone. It grew stronger, heavier. She resisted it. From the very beginning, it felt wrong, and it only got worse. There was restlessness in her, an urgency to scream. And all this wrongness, this urgency, it only happened at night. By the light of day, she was fine, and that seemed a further clue that it was a dark, bad thing inside her. Welling up, building up, rising, filling her. Something in her that should not have been there. And every night that passed, it was harder to resist its compulsions. Her throat wanted to scream. Her soul wanted it too. She fought against it, as though there were demons in her trying to claw their way out and ravage the world.
"Let them," Minya would have said. "The world deserves ravaging."
It was Minya who finally dragged it out of her. Dragged them out. Her 100 smithereens of darkness.
I see what you're doing.
She'd accused Sarai one night, cornering her in the garden. That was the year they were the same age. Sarai had caught up to her, and would soon grow past her, while Minya stayed forever the same.
You think I can't tell?
The little girl had demanded.
You're hiding your gift. Well, it's not yours to hide. Whatever it is, it belongs to all of us.
Sarai didn't dispute that. They were in this together, and she'd had such hopes that her gift might set them free. But those hopes were all gone.
What if it's bad?
She'd whispered, fearful.
Bad would be good,
Minya had said, fervent.
We need bad, Sarai, for vengeance.
She knew how to say the word, gritted teeth and spittle flying, all her hate bound up in it. Her own gift was what it was. She could punish the humans, but only once they were dead, and that did not satisfy. Sarai might have dreamed of flying and escape, but not Minya. She'd hoped Sarai's magic would prove a weapon against their enemy. And the two little girls might have looked like equals that night in the garden, like playmates, but they weren't. Minya was the fearsome elder sister who had saved all their lives, and they would do anything for her, even hate for her. That part was easy, really. Natural. They'd known nothing else. Ghosts, the Citadel, and hating the humans who hated them. So Sarai gave in to the scream that night, and the dark things within her took wing. They came boiling out between her lips, and they weren't demons after all, but moths. The horror of it. Insects emerging from her body. When it was finally over, that first emergence, 5 or 10 seconds that felt like an eternity, she'd fallen to her knees and lost her supper between the roots of a plum tree. Minya had watched it all with wide eyes and sick fascination. The moths were frantic because Sarai was frantic. They whipped and whirled through a desperate choreography. Sarai's throat burned, from the vomit, not the moths. Later, she would come to understand that they didn't actually boil up her throat. They weren't really in her, not like that. They were of her, a dimension of her mind or soul that took form only as they emerged. Somewhere in the air of her scream they coalesced. She felt the brush of fur soft wings against her lips, but that was all. She didn't choke on them. She wasn't a living hive with a belly full of chrysalids that hatched at darkfall. Nothing so terrible. But it was terrible enough that first time, and wild and jarring and dizzying. She knelt between plum roots and reeled. Her mind felt peeled open, skinned and scattered. She clung to a knob of root as the world broke into pieces and spun. She could see through the moth's eyes, all 100 of them at once. That was the dizziness, the reeling and spinning. She could see what they could see, and hear what they could hear, and smell and taste what they could too, and even feel whatever their wings and feet and feather antennae touched. This was her gift, grotesque and marvelous. Her consciousness had wings. She couldn't fly, but it could. It was a kind of escape, but it mocked freedom. She was still a prisoner, a secret monster. But now she was a prisoner and secret monster who could spy on the life that she could never have. If that had been all, it would still have been useful. To have a window into weep, at night at least, if not by day, the moths being strictly nocturnal, to see something of the enemy and know what they were doing. But it wasn't all. It was only the beginning of her dark, strange ability. Tonight, a child no longer, Sarai did as she had done 4,000 nights before. She stepped out onto her terrace and screamed her moths at the sky. They descended on weep, fanning out over the roof-tile topography as though it had been sectored on a map, They divvied it between them, dove down chimneys, squeezed through cracks in shutters. They were dark, small, and lovely. The exact purple of the lining of night, with the shot silk shimmer of starlight on dark water. Their antennae were plumes fit to fan a tiny queen, their bodies like willow buds, compact, furred, marvelous. Up on her terrace, Sarai paced. Restless energy coursed through her. She could never be still when her moths were abroad. Her eyes were open, but out of focus. She left just enough of her consciousness seated in her body to do that much. Paced the length of her terrace, and know if anyone came near her. The rest of her mind was in weep, in 100 places at once. She entered Ari Isle's house, among others. The window was open. Her moth flew right in. His corpse was laid out on the kitchen table. She didn't touch him, but only looked. He was handsome even now, but his stillness was terrible. The gulf between sleep and death immense. It was strange to see his empty shell when his ghost had so recently been in the citadel. When humans died, their souls clung invisibly to their bodies for as long as they could, a day or two. And then they lost their grip and were claimed by the natural pull of evanescence. The sky took them. They rose up and returned to it, and were subsumed by it. Unless Minya caught them, of course, and kept them to play with. Ari Isle had been unmarried. This was his family home, and his younger sister nodded at his side, asleep at her vigil. Her name was Haver. She was Sarai's age, and Sarai couldn't help thinking how different the girl's life would be if the gods were still alive. At the same time that she was there, in Ari Isle's kitchen, she was entering other houses, watching other faces. Among them were women who hadn't been as lucky as Haver, but had been young when the gods ruled Weep. It hadn't been Weep then, of course. That name came with the bloodshed, but it suited the 2 centuries of Mizathim reign. If there had been anything in abundance in all those years, it had surely been tears. All these homes, all these people, scattered toys and battered boots and everything so different than it was in the citadel. There was no Mizathim in these houses, but tile and wood and stone. Handmade quilts and woven rugs and cats curled right beside the humans in their mussed-up beds. Sarai went to them, the humans, not the cats. And moths found the sleepers in their beds. Their touch was light. The sleepers never woke. Men and women, children and grandparents. The moths perched on their brows, or on the ridges of their cheekbones. There was intimacy in it. Sarai knew the scents of humans and the rhythms of their breathing. She was a connoisseur of eyelashes, the way they rested, the way they fluttered, and the texture of skin around the eyes, how fragile it was and earliest to wrinkle, and the dart and flicker of the orb beneath the lid. She could tell at a glance if a sleeper was dreaming, or was in that restful state between dreams. No one who ever lived, she thought, knew more of shut eyes than she did. She saw her share of bare skin, too, brown, not blue, and watched the pulse of unprotected throats and tender, pale wrists. She saw people at their most vulnerable, both alone and together, sleeping, or else doing the other things that are done in the dark. There were, it turned out, an untold number of ways that bodies could intertwine. That was an education. It used to be funny and shocking. She would tell the others about it first thing in the mornings, and they would gasp and giggle. But it wasn't funny or shocking anymore. It had crept over her imperceptibly. A kind of stirring, an allure. Sarai understood Ruby's hunger. She didn't spy on such private moments anymore, but even the sight of a strong, bare arm, crooked gently round a waist or shoulder, could make her ache with the yearning to be held. To be one of a pair of bodies that knew that melting fusion. To reach and find. to be reached for and found, to belong to a mutual certainty, to wake up holding hands.
Up in the citadel, Sarai's throat